This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris emphasized the power of hope Monday, along with new efforts to fight corruption to persuade Latin Americans to stay home rather than attempt the dangerous migration north to the United States. In her first foreign trip as U.S. second-in-command, Harris said at a news conference in Guatemala City that people in the Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, along with Mexico, need economic development that promises a better life than trying to move to the U.S. Harris said that help is on the way with Washington aid and private investments encouraged by the U.S. government in agriculture, housing, and businesses. But Harris did warn Guatemalans, do not come to the U.S. She said, we are not afraid to enforce our laws and borders. Harris held what she described a very frank, very candid talk with the Guatemalan president about corruption, pressing the need for a strong court system and civil governance. Shortly after she met with the Guatemalan leader, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced in Washington the creation of a law enforcement task force aimed at fighting human trafficking and smuggling groups in Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries. Two candidates vying for Peru's presidency were still neck and neck Monday as votes counts trickled. And for the runoff election, with over 95% of the vote, the socialist Pedro Castillo still led the conservative rival by less than one percentage point, according to a Reuters tally. Castillo, an outsider candidate, barely gained a lead against his rival overnight as votes came in from rural areas of the country. This is VOA News. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to decide whether it's sex discrimination for the government to require only men to register for the draft when they turn to the age of 18. The ACLU Women's Rights Project had urged the court to take up the issue. It says requiring men to register imposes a serious burden on men that's not imposed on women. The last time there was a U.S. military draft was during the Vietnam War, and the military has been all volunteer since. But the registration requirement for the draft is one of the few remaining places where federal law treats men and women differently. Men who do not register can lose eligibility for student loans and civil service jobs. Failing to register is also a felony punishable by a fine of up to $250,000 and 5 years in prison. Women's rights groups are among those arguing that allowing the men-only requirement to stand is harmful. A South Korean court has rejected a claim by dozens of wartime Korean factory workers and their relatives who sought compensation from Japanese companies for their slave labor before the end of World War II. The decision by the Seoul Central District Court appeared to run against landmark Supreme Court rulings in 2018 that sided with forced laborers. It largely aligns with the position maintained by Tokyo, which has insisted that all wartime compensation issues were settled under a 1965 treaty normalizing relations. Both countries have faced pressure from the Biden administration to repair the relations that sank to post-war lows during the Trump years over history and trade disputes. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations met Monday with the head of the U.N. Population Fund. It was the first such high-level engagement in more than 4 years. The U.S. Mission to the United Nations said Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield highlighted the resumption of extensive support to the organization, which provides health care to millions of women and girls around the world. After the meeting, Thomas Greenfield tweeted that she's delighted to announce the resumption of U.S. humanitarian funding for UNFPA, including support for the Rohingya refugee crisis, Afghanistan, Sudan, and those fleeing the Tigray regions of Ethiopia. Scientists say the annual peak of global heat trapping carbon dioxide in the air has reached another dangerous milestone, 50% higher than when the industrial age began, and the average rate of increase is faster than ever, according to scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration on Monday. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, in for James Batty. Today is Tuesday, June 8th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Mali's new interim president, Assimi Goïta, promises to hold democratic elections by early next year. This was one of the conditions set by France to resume cooperation with Malian forces.
Goïta is trying to reassure the international public opinion and international partners.
Bakare Sambe is the director of the Timbuktu Institute Research Group. The WHO is warning that the COVID-19 global pandemic is trending upwards in 14 African countries, with at least 8 countries witnessing a spike of over 30% in cases. In Nigeria, One Love Foundation, a human rights NGO, has petitioned the ECOWAS court seeking to challenge the Nigerian government's indefinite suspension of Twitter operations in the country.
Asking for the federal government of Nigeria and the NBC to reverse such ban that it runs contrary to Article 7 of the African Charter on Human and People's Rights.
Samuel Hesekian is the organization's lawyer. And Uganda has launched a 50 million car manufacturing plant. The project will produce buses, tourism vehicles, and other automobiles in the next 6 years. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story today, we start off in Mali. A promise by the country's new interim president to hold democratic elections by early next year appears to meet some conditions set by France to resume recently suspended cooperation with Malian forces. But some hope that Paris is slowly heading for the exit when it comes to its years-long Barkhane anti-terrorist operation in the Sahel. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
France's announcement last week that it was halting counterinsurgency cooperation with Malian forces followed Mali's second coup in less than a year. President Emmanuel Macron denounced the power grab as unacceptable, warning also that he would pull French troops from Mali altogether if it tipped to radical Islam. Sworn in as Mali's latest interim president days later, junta leader Assimi Goïta vowed to preserve his country's democratic gains and meet promises to hold elections by next February. Not everyone believes him.
I think that Assimi Goïta is trying to reassure the international public opinion and international partners. But in the meantime, since the first transition, we see that the military tried to keep themselves in power. And the last coup is an illustration of this voluntary to stay in power.
Bakary Sambe is director of the Timbuktu Institute Research Group. He says while Goïta and his military junta are under pressure, so too is Macron, as he eyes next year's presidential elections at home and sharpens his anti-terrorism rhetoric. Support for keeping France's 8-year-old 5,100-man Barkhane anti-terrorism operation in the Sahel is fading, both in France and in the countries where it operates, as anti-French sentiment is mounting. Meanwhile, Sambe says some Malians support Goïta and the idea of holding talks with at least some armed groups in the country, which France rejects.
Venturing sanctions against the junta will be perceived as a double punishment against the Malian, who already doubt the effectiveness of the action of the international community, which has neither defeated terrorism nor stabilized Mali.
Meanwhile, here in France, some hope the suspension of cooperation with Mali's army will be the first step to a bigger drawdown and eventual French military exit from the Sahel, a vast area edging the Sahara Desert that is rife with instability. Others say they aren't so sure that will happen. French anti-terrorism specialist Marc-Antoine Pérouse de Monclos says no other forces in the region can take France's place. Meanwhile, he told France's TV5 Monde channel that militants are profiting from the security void. And he notes Mali isn't France's only partner in the Sahel counterinsurgency effort. A broader so-called G5 coalition also includes Mauritania, Chad, Niger, and Burkina Faso. A case in point is Burkina Faso, where suspected Islamist militants killed at least 160 people early Saturday. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian heads to Ouagadougou this week to show France's solidarity, illustrating the bigger ties binding France to a complicated conflict. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The WHO is warning that COVID-19 is trending upwards in 14 countries across the African continent, with at least 8 countries witnessing a spike of over 30% in cases. But even as the vaccine rollout continues to lag across the African continent, some health experts worry that public perception and skepticism about the vaccines continues to hinder efforts by some African countries to inoculate their populations. The WHO estimates that vaccine distribution is at 31 million doses that have been administered in 50 African countries. It says that only 2% of the population has so far received one dose of the vaccine, which is very low when compared to the 24% global average. But whether the fight against the coronavirus will come down to vaccine access or vaccine hesitancy will be hard to tell, since we still have issues with data collection on the continent. Dr. Kemi Olugemo is a Nigerian-American scientist and health advocate. She tells me that fighting the pandemic has to be a global effort that addresses the inefficient global vaccine distribution while addressing the hesitancy in some communities to receive the vaccine.
So there's definitely a risk that the data that we have is skewed, and you're right. So we can only rely on the data that we have. We may not be testing as often as we should, and we may not, we may not be really getting, all of the different people, in the cities versus, in the more rural areas. So I think it's going to boil down to leadership in each individual country in terms of, the government and the community coming together to make sure that as a community, we're following guidelines. So in terms of social distancing, wearing masks, and then, for those that have symptoms, making sure that they find a site and access a place where they can get tested. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. We don't know if the data that we have is absolutely correct.
Now, I've seen reports that at the current rate at which countries like Nigeria, it would take almost a decade to inoculate the entire population in Nigeria against COVID-19. We know that this is partly due to the lack of access to the vaccines themselves, but how much of this would you say has to do with, that hesitancy by some people receive the vaccine?
So I'm not sure that we can explain access issues by hesitancy alone, particularly in a country like Nigeria. For many of the developing countries, so outside of the Western regions, we rely heavily on COVAX, the alliance that the World Health Organization has with the European Commission to enable equitable vaccine access for really the entire world. And, Nigeria now has access to at least one or two vaccines. I know that Ghana was the first country to receive COVID-19s under this particular initiative. But I think, this is going to be a global effort in terms of making sure that there's enough access, within the country to vaccines. In terms of hesitancy within a country like Nigeria, I think some of the reasons may be similar to what we see here. So, some of them are a lot of people rely on their faith, or they perhaps think that they're not at a high risk because they don't have the right information. I know that many people worry that the vaccines can alter your DNA, which is absolutely not correct. Some people worry about fertility issues. There's no evidence for that. But when you look at the issue of hesitancy within the U.S., I think that there are some things that are intrinsic to the United States, such as political climate and overall anti-science, thinking. And when I say that, unfortunately, I think about people who are just generally anti-vaxxers, even before COVID started. So, we know that the vaccines for COVID were developed very quickly, and as a matter of fact, the fastest vaccines that we've ever had. But one thing a lot of people need to remember is that no process was skipped in terms of getting these vaccines to emergency use authorization. When you think about the risks of COVID, and you think about the risk of getting the vaccines, in terms of even the safety data that we have that shows very small side effects that could be severe, I think that the risk-benefit ratio is undoubtedly very clear.
So what advice would you give to people who are hesitant to receive the vaccine?
So I think that it's there's nothing wrong with having questions, and questions are, they're good. It means you're paying attention and you're listening. But I think that people need to be open to getting the information so that they can make the best possible decision. There are lots of people who are working on vaccine hesitancy and getting this information out to people and making sure that there's access. One of those is an organization that I'm involved with, a nonprofit called Women of Color in Pharma. And what we've done is make a concerted effort to educate people about the overall vaccine development process, the steps that were taken, why it was fast, what the safety data shows us, how effective the vaccines are. They're very effective. Once you get two doses of Moderna or Pfizer, or you get your one dose of Johnson & Johnson, your risk of getting a severe illness or dying is extremely low compared to if you don't get the vaccine. So I would say that people need to ask the right questions, get the right data. People need to go to familiar places, so it's the safe spaces that are important in getting the information to people. And we have protections in place, even after you get the vaccine, to get continuing accumulation of safety data to continue monitoring the effect, especially in populations that may not have been studied adequately in clinical trials.
That was Dr. Kemi Olugemo, a Nigerian-American scientist and healthcare advocate. I reached her in her offices in Boston. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Negotiating solutions to the global war crisis triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic will be at the center of discussions at the International Labour Conference over the next 2 weeks. Some 4,700 delegates from 176 countries have registered to attend this conference, held virtually for the first time because of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
During his opening remarks, Director General of the International Labour Organization, Guy Ryder, told his largely invisible audience that global action was required to overcome what he called the cataclysmic impact of COVID-19 on the world of work. He said this work crisis was four times as severe as the one triggered by the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. He said 255 million full-time jobs had been lost last year because of the pandemic, wiping out $3.7 trillion of labor income.
108 million people pushed back into working poverty, and the most vulnerable and already disadvantaged hit hardest. Young people, women, informal workers, migrants. The pandemic has confronted us with unbearable brutality, with the reality and consequences of the multiple and growing inequalities in our societies.
Ryder notes the pandemic has worsened the inequalities that already existed. He said they have hardened into deep structural injustice, widening the fairness gap between the rich and poor countries. He said all societies have suffered unbearable loss in health and wealth. But he said recovery from the pandemic was now underway in wealthy countries that have access to life-saving vaccines. These countries, he added, can look forward to getting back quite rapidly to pre-pandemic levels of GDP. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Nigeria, One Love Foundation, a human rights NGO, has petitioned the ECOWAS court seeking to challenge the Nigerian government's indefinite suspension of Twitter operations in the country. The group's lawyer, Samuel Ihensekian Jr., says that the organization's actions come after the administration in Abuja failed to reverse the suspension. This is after the group's two-day ultimatum demanding a reversal elapsed Sunday. Announcing the suspension last week, Nigerian Information Minister Lai Mohammed says the social media platform is being used to undermine the country's corporate existence. Meanwhile, top envoys in Western countries have expressed disappointment with Twitter's suspension. In a joint statement, the envoys expressed concern that the ban undermines Nigeria's constitutional provisions that guarantee free speech Local media reports that envoys held a meeting in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, Monday with Foreign Affairs Minister Geoffrey Onyema. Samuel Isekian Jr., lawyer for the One Love Foundation, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the Nigerian government's decision is illegal and was carried out in bad faith.
We did issue the press release asking for the federal government of Nigeria and the NBC to reverse such ban that it runs contrary to Article 7 of the African Charter on Human and People's Rights and Section 22 of the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria 1999. And other enabling sections of our constitution, and we quickly act them because it negates on citizens' rights to uphold, impart, and receive information, and it impedes their rights and guards the right of the Nigerian press to actually hold the government to accountability. We did issue the press statement, and in confirmation of our letter, we did file a case on this aspect. Irrespective of the ban by the federal government on Twitter, asking for the court for some release today.
What specifically is your organization seeking from the court to do?
First of all, it is our view as an organization that the ban by the Nigerian government on Twitter is actually not done in good faith. The ban is unconstitutional, it is illegal, and it is something, when challenged in court, we feel it will not survive the test of legality. And we are consequently seeking from the court an interpretation of the African Charter, whether the Nigerian government can actually shut down the microblogging site, can actually ban it from Nigerian airspace. Taking into cognizance the directive by the Minister for Justice in Nigeria, the AGF, who has actually criminalized.
Some people are suggesting that the Nigerian government was right to take the decision because it has the constitutional mandate to protect life and property, and that the Twitter Nigeria is being used to undermine the country's peace and stability, and that is why the government had to act. What say you?
In our own view, I don't think that appears to be the position. The economic benefit and the advantages of Twitter.com outweighs any negative opinion that anybody has. Twitter is a microblogging site that Nigerians earn as much as 200 million every day. Twitter also has a policy whereby they ensure transparency and they ensure that tweets that are anti-people, tweets that are capable of undermining security, they have a checkmate where such tweets are being removed from their line.
What would be your next line of action if the court's ruling favor you, yet the Nigerian government does not adhere to the court's ruling? Because some people argue that this is an internal problem.
Yeah, we if not for the judicial strike, we would have also approached the Federal High Court. We are taking it from two ends. The ECOWAS court has a persuasive authority, and Nigeria is a member, and they have signed they are a party to the ECOWAS treaty. We believe in good faith and in good conscience, Nigeria being a responsible country, if the judgment comes in our favor, they will respect it.
Samuel Isekian Jr., the lawyer for the One Love Foundation, he was speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty. Tensions are mounting ahead of Gambia's presidential elections scheduled for December 24th, 2021. And supporters of President Adama Barrow's National People's Party, NPP, over the weekend stormed the street of the capital city, Banjul, calling on the Banjul mayor to stay away from the ongoing voter registration exercise. The mayor has been accused of issuing attestations to her supporters to obtain voters' cards, a charge she has denied. Reporter Panderimbai reports.
Banjul was the scene of a protest march on Saturday. As supporters of President Barrow's National People's Party, NPP, accused the mayor of Banjul of electoral fraud. The accusations came barely 6 months before the presidential elections scheduled for December 4, 2021. Bashiru Ndau, an NPP executive member, was the main man behind the protest action.
The whole entire community of Banjul have a concern about this voter registration concerning the registration. So they just wanted to come out to voice their concern for the whole world to know that some of them were denied the attestation, and they feel like two from the outside in the Combos were given the attestation. So that was the reason for them coming out to protest.
Ndau says the mayor hasn't been compliant when it comes to the procedure of obtaining the country's national documents.
I believe that the attestation should be for them to enable them to have a birth certificate. if they lose all their documents, their national documents, they can use the attestation to go to the Minister of Health to try to obtain a birth certificate. But the IEC attestation form clearly indicates the alcalde or the CFO should do the attestations, not the mayor.
Mayor Rohi Malik Lowe is the second deputy national president of the main opposition United Democratic Party, UDP. She has been providing attestation for residents of Banjul to be issued voters' cards. Ibu Seka is the NPP Banjul campaign manager.
The thing that happened is very worrying. We observed a lot of people, a group of people, young people from other non-Banjulians, having attestation in their hands, walking towards BCC, entering BCC and coming out with those attestations, and then go to the registration center where they issue them voters' cards. So this is too worrying, because the problem is they are without documents, supporting documents, whether they are Gambians or they are not Gambians. There is nothing certain in issuing this card.
The protest action followed queries made by the leader of the opposition PDIS, questioning the legality of the mayor's meddling into the voter registration exercise. Seka again.
That could be unconstitutional power. Regarding the status of the mayor, is a political figure, then she is elected. She is not selected. And if you give that person the power to issue national voting card, it's very worrying.
The mayor has denied the allegations. She has denied registering non-Gambians to vote in Gambia's elections scheduled for December 4, 2021. Alma Mittal is the spokesman for the main opposition UDP.
To suggest that she is only giving attestation to people who are sympathetic to the UDP, I'm sure is just the usual political talk that the political of no issues people are up and about.
The chairman of Gambia's Election Commission says there is nothing illegal for the mayor of Banjul to attest voters to secure voters' cards. Tal agrees. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Uganda has launched a 50 million car manufacturing plant, and the project will produce buses, tourism vehicles, and other automobiles in the next 6 years. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni says the factory will create employment opportunities for hundreds of youth in the country. Reporter Mugume Davis Gwakarinji files from Kampala, Uganda.
While launching the car manufacturing project in the western district of Kasese, local proprietor Metu Katabazi said his company will produce at least 100 buses within the next 5 years. He said his company aims at reducing dependency on second-hand imported vehicles that cost the economy foreign revenue. He said once full-fledged, his company will employ at least 2,000 people, mainly youth from the area.
The first project will be the manufacturing of assorted buses, such as road buses, city buses, light buses, tourist buses, school buses. And through this project here in Kasese, we shall make Uganda self-sufficient in automobile and machinery in the next 6 years. We want everybody in Uganda to drive a new car.
Over the years, the government has discouraged the importation of used vehicles. In 2018, the government passed a law banning vehicles that are older than 15 years with the intention of reducing pollution and ensuring safety. Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, Uganda's president, while presiding on the launch of the manufacturing plant, said the project will create new forms of wealth for the country.
When you buy second-hand cars, Uganda will not get these 2,000 jobs, you hear of the youth in Kasese. Those jobs will not be there, and they are not there now because we are importing a lot of second-hand vehicles. But who is making those vehicles? Somebody else. But secondly, the second-hand cars are also not good. I think even for health, they may not be good, but also for the environment.
More than 25,000 automobiles were imported in the country last year, according to Uganda's tax body, the Uganda Revenue Authority. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June the 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good week ahead, Africa.